I enjoy coming here. It's such a full sangha. It's a pleasure. I live in a little town in North Carolina, and so our sangha, I guess, is about half of this. And so I like it when I come into a full house, yeah. So if you don't mind, I'd like to open up this evening with something that might be a little different. We were almost late because we were looking for a copy of the Samyutta Nikaya. Now, I know that insight has its foundation in Theravada, you know, Buddhism. Y'all need to get some Theravada books up there then. So I'm just saying. You know, so I was looking for a copy of the Samyutta, and I saw everybody's books up there because I want to share some things over this weekend, and I didn't want y'all to think I was making it up. So I wanted to just have the book to be my backup, that it's really in there, whether you've heard it before or not. But I think everything that's in there is in there for a reason, and it's to allow us to have a well-balanced view of things so that we can make the most progress. So whenever I encounter something in the Dharma that seems a little suspect to me, I mean, like it's just not in my sphere of experience, rather than chucking it outright, you know, because I found so many things that turned out to be true that, this might be also. And so I will just like sit it aside. If you could see a copy of my earlier books, I've grown a little bit and I don't do it so much now. Everything I read now, I'm like, I know that's right. But in the beginning, I'd write, that's not true. I tried that. That didn't work. You know, and I looked over the years of using the book, how my mind was changed by simply allowing some information to come in that I wasn't already aware of, something that challenged my view, and there was this opening so that I could see. You know, they did this study. I am going to open up in a minute. There's a study that they did on rats, and they fed them, and it was a horizontal pathway to the food. And after a while, they created a vertical, and they moved the food to the vertical pathway, and they starved to death. And it tells us about how much our patterns, our habit controls our ways of thinking, and not only our ways of thinking, but actually what we see and how we hear. And so the Dharma is designed to help free us from that. And if we cannot see or understand it, sometimes it's just because we have, you know, a habitual way of doing something, or a habitual way of seeing something, or a habitual way of hearing something, or a habitual way of understanding something that blocks off our access to the prajna that's coming towards us and looking for resonance within us. Because it's not really anything out here to learn. He said that we all have the Buddha nature, that our intrinsic nature, our original face is the Dhammakaya, that's the truth body. He said if it weren't so, it'd be no way to even like bring you into this, because you wouldn't have the material for fruit to come forth. But because we do have the Buddha nature, then he can bring these things to our awareness, and they can and the witness can be born within us, and that's how we grow. So you see, actually it's us remembering, not so much us learning something new or becoming something different, but returning to our own original face, our own intrinsic nature. So, okay, so let's open now. Incense burning, all space is filled with the fragrance. All Buddha smell it from afar. Auspicious clouds gather everywhere. With utmost sincerity, all Buddhas appear. We pay homage and offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. We pay homage and offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. We pay homage and offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. So some of us think that the only beings that we that are in this room are the ones that we can see. But the Buddha speaks about so many different worlds and so many different classifications of beings. And sometimes we can be in a place or be in a room where there's a certain kind of energy and a certain kind of sense about the room, and you wonder, like, what is causing that? What is bringing that? And many times it's just the presence of many beings that we can't even see. Now, I know we think we're at the top of the food chain, but I have to tell you, if the best that could be done was what we do as human beings, well, I don't know who created the world then, because we could use a lot of help. So in the Samyutta Nikaya, there's a section, a chapter on the Gandhavas. There's also a chapter on the Devas, and there's also a chapter on the deities. It is also a chapter on the Brahmas, and there's also a chapter. And all of these are part of the cosmology that the Buddha shared with us. The difference, I could say, is that he recognized that classification of being is tied into capacity to act, you know. So I guess my cats think I'm a god because I know when they're hungry, I know when they're sick, you know. I can, like, move these huge, huge doors when they want to go outside, you know. When I take them to the vet, divine transportation, it's like, you know. But I'm just functioning in my normal capacity as what we classify ourselves as human beings, you know. And so the Buddha talked about many different kinds of beings, and I'll tell you, my cat has respect for me because she relies on me. Now, I don't think that's anything special. I just function in my normal capacity, you know, with my five fingers on each hand and five toes and two legs to walk upright. I just do what I do. And so it's that way with all beings, you know. But the thing is that when we can recognize that there is somewhere to go, that there is some quality to attain. And he talks about entering into the Brahma Viharas. It wasn't just a word that was made up to contain loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. He was talking about the mind state of Brahmas as a classification of being. And when our mind enters, or when our state gets to that plane or that field, then we think just like the gods. That's what I'm talking about. And so he talks about human beings, and he calls us the ordinary, run-of-the-mill, untaught worldlings. And he says that you can stay in that condition, or you can enter into other states. And he begins to give a training, a teaching on how to enter into those states. I mean, if we really think about it, when we are upset with someone, when we are in sorrow, when we are full of anger, when we are jealous, when we are feeling less than another, feeling a sense of shame, when we're in any of these kinds of moods, there is a kind of suffering there. And when we are in a state of joy, or when we are satisfied, when we are helpful, feeling helpful, knowing that we are helpful, there's a different kind of feeling that we have. We change our state. We enter into a different state. And so these practices are designed for us to know how to enter into that state. He summed up his teachings very simply, said three things: do good, stop doing evil, and purify your mind. I mean, look, if we just did that, I mean, that's 99% of the practice. But we have formed and fashioned practice into something else. We've made it another one of our intellectual pursuits. We've made it another one of our activities that we do to take up our day, or to fill our week, or to give us some sense of being smart or superior or knowing. And it's not for any of those reasons. But it is for us to return, to uncover, to actualize, to realize our intrinsic Buddha nature. So the only difference between one who is a Buddha and an ordinary worldling is that the Buddha knows that he is one. And Buddha is as Buddha does. Yeah. So if we spent our time just thinking in the moment, what is doing good in this moment? What does that mean? What does that look like? What does that feel like? That could be the sum total of our practice. He said, meditate all the time, O monks. This is my advice to you. When you're sitting, when you're standing, when you're walking, and when you're lying down. But we have like a formal sitting practice, you know? And we can tell everybody about our formal sitting practice. And we have a procedure for exactly how to do it. Not understanding spiritual language. And so we take language prajna, and we turn it into ordinary words, and we start literally carrying out the words. But there's a way of speaking that if one is tapped in, they understand the real meaning of something. So a lot of times we're talking about how some teachers speak about the secret teachings. It's not really secret, but it's whether one has the capacity to understand spiritual language as opposed to ordinary language. It's like one who has ears to hear, let him hear. It's something like that. And so we get these teachings and we receive them as we are. And in time, as we have some kind of little insight, we think like, wow, that was a good teaching. It was the same old teaching. It's just that we have had some kind of a breakthrough. There's been a penetration of the language prajna, and it finds its mark in us, and we shift. And when we are locked into that new view, when we are embodying it, then we become acharyas, dharmacharyas, those who embody the Dharma. So I think that sometimes we need to reassess how we are approaching the Dharma. And that's what I wanted to do this weekend. So we're not going to have a whole lot of intellectual stimulation, but we want to try to take it right to the heart. So they tell me I was too late in sending the title of the topic. You know, you should be careful what you wish for. Because every time somebody asks me for a topic, I deliberately delay in sending it. Because I would say, you know, when they wanted the Buddha to come and give a talk, they didn't say, and send us a title, too. Well, one of the reasons, though, you know, I said, well, you know, people have to decide whether they want to come to here. They just can't show up to hear the Dharma, that's all, you know. And I tell you what's so good about that. It allows one to be able to be here now, be right here in the present moment, you know, wrapping mind with mind, getting a sense of what needs to be said right now and in what way that needs to be articulated. That it might be of some benefit to the people who are in this room. They record my messages at Heartwood every Sunday. I said, we got to knock this off, because the thing is, they are really, really good messages. But you know what? They're for the people who are there at that moment. And we listen to them later, like, you know, it doesn't exactly compute. It was like we had a high time in there. You know, but you listen, it's just some blah, blah. It's just some talk. You know, because it was a rhema, it was a word incident, it was for that moment, and it was for those who were in assembly there. And so the Buddha said that's how the truth comes forth, even when there is something to correct. You know, the thing is that when there is something to correct, it's wonderful, and that person by which we had an opportunity to discuss that thing that needed to be corrected, actually, it inures to their merit. Because if they hadn't done that thing, we would not have been able to have this wonderful teaching. So that's what I always tell, especially if I'm doing a correction Sunday. I'm like, don't feel bad. You have blessed us because you gave us substance, you know, for our coming together. So I think they all like take turns to see, you know, who the Dharma talk's gonna be on next next week. That's a good way to get them used to accepting accountability for their own actions, you know. And so we are in a place that we can just talk about things because people don't take it personally. Oh, they did when we first started. No, because everybody's so tender. Everybody's so easily triggered. Everybody, you know, so fragile. Everybody's so insecure. Everybody's so, you know, where does that fit with the Dharma? Especially for practitioners who've been practicing for 10, 20, 30 years. If your Dharma doesn't have any power, it's not the rhythm, you need to get another one. Because this Dharma has power. And has the capacity, you know, to make it possible for you to handle anything that comes into your path in the course of a day. So the only security that we're going to have is that which is within us, you know. The only joy we're going to have is that which we bring up in us. The only safety, even down to the only love. You know, if I walked in that door looking for somebody to love me, well, I might be disappointed. You know, because I may not find anybody in here that loves me. But when I come in with enough for myself, I mean, that's sufficient. You don't have to have too much for yourself. Just enough. Just right. You know? That's that whole thing about the balance. Having just enough. Because when it's weighted properly in that way, there's not the highs and the lows. We don't think of ourselves too highly. We don't think of ourselves too lowly. Just right. And the thing about something being balanced and just right is that after a while, no need to think about it at all. And so we find ourselves just doing without doing, you know, or doing without there being a doer, and yet nothing goes undone. So for the ones who are struggling to do good, to be good, to do things for people, but there's always that recognition, I am doing. You know, don't quite have it yet. And for that one who feels guilty, you know, because they don't feel that they do enough, they are still being self-centered. So my daughter, she was very shy coming up. And I got a little bit of wisdom because it was not going to be good for her. She was like just over the top, too shy. And it dawned on me that being overly extroverted and overly shy was still a focus on oneself. And so I would talk to her about that. I didn't say, oh, you're so selfish. But I'd say, you know, you have too much focus on yourself. When you start forgetting about yourself and focusing on others, then you'll be at ease with everybody. People may have an issue with you, but you won't have one with anyone. And that's how I broke her out of that. Because I saw it's a different kind, it's like a pride in reverse, but it's still pride. The Buddha teaches us in these kinds of ways. So the more words that we use, you know, I said, you know, like, I never read anywhere where he praised scholars. I'm sorry if we got any in the room. This is not a personal indictment. I'm just saying that he praised not the scholar, but the one who actually reflected until they came to a penetration of their delusion. Some of those people were not educated. Some of them, I mean, you know, they didn't have Google back in those days, you know. I mean, I love Google. If I want to know something, I have like an extensive library, but I have no need now. Just Google it, you know, and I get all of these things. And they can be useful in their place. But as I was telling my students this evening on our conference call, because I was late, if you teach, don't be late when you have a bunch of Dhamma teachers as students, because they like just jump right in and they like go wherever they want to go. So when I tapped into the call, they had already pulled some other scholars, you know, comments about our topic for tonight. And this particular one was on a sutta, and I'm going to just give you an example of how we major on the minors. There was this one sutta called one, sometimes it's translated one special night, one excellent night, one auspicious day. You know, it says some translated day, some translated night. And there was this whole commentary on the word and whether it should be day or night. And this scholar had written this whole thing about, well, you know, that's because they started the day with the evening and it went around, you know, instead of starting it in the morning. And they were engrossed in this whole thing. They're like, hey, cut that out. You know, they were in this whole thing because they missed the whole point of the sutta. It was talking about that right there. It was talking about that right there. And so that's how we do, because that's our tendency. That's the tendency of the conceptualizing mind. But when we talk about Buddha nature, or that the luminous mind, or that emptiness, we're not talking about conceptualizing mind. And so until we know how to allow that to rest, that it's good, my Buddha master calls it scattered wisdom, the scattered wisdom that comes from the conceptualizing mind. It's scattered because it's taking information from all of these outside places, you know, what we hear and see and taste and touch and smell and what we think. So we have eye consciousness, no, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, mind consciousness. But it's based on limited and faulty information. Like you hear part of a conversation and you walk away with the wrong idea. Or you can hear the whole conversation. We all can. But we could come up with however many people in here, that many different versions of what was just said. Because it's not actually what we see, but how we see. And it's not actually what is being said, but how we hear. And so we have a world that we have created, each one of us, according to how we see and how we hear and how we individually think. Now, if you think about how many people in the world, and the Buddha said, you know, in this Saha world, there's some worlds that have beings with same form, same mind. And some worlds of beings have same form, different minds. And some worlds have beings that have same, different form, same mind. And some worlds that have different form and different mind. He said, that's this one, you know. So how could we even expect to agree? So if I have it as a supposition that it is very, very difficult for two people to align with one agreement, it makes me more open, vaster in my recognition that it might take more effort for us to get on the same page, you know. And that's what allows patience to flower in us. But if we don't have that mind, if we don't come to that understanding, if we can't see how true that is, then we'll get pissed off every time people don't agree with us. No, we like, why can't they see that? I mean, I don't understand. You know. But he said, it's a fool that is not interested in understanding others, but that only wants his own views and his own thoughts to be accepted. So when one is insisting on their own way, when one has to be the smartest, when one has to know everything, you could just know what kind of mind that is, right? I mean, you know, I'm just saying. When you get around people that know, I mean, it is the best medicine. Once you know what they know, because it encourages you, you know, to stop acting in that way because you are known. Do you understand what I mean? That's why it'd be very difficult to fool a Sangha that is practicing, because they can know. This is ordinary knowing for a practicing Sangha. That's why we don't have to be afraid. Because in the conduct of embodying the Dhamma comes prajna. We can't get wisdom. The prajna unfolds in the conduct of our doing good, stopping doing evil, purifying the mind. That's really simple. It's really simple. It's too simple, because we need things to be hard. We need things to be difficult. We need things to be worthy of our effort. We need But he leaves us without excuse. So in this moment, what would the good heart do in this moment? And then do that thing, right? You think of what it would do, how it would respond, how it would act. But here comes the test, and then do that thing. What would you want done for you in that situation? I mean, they would get on me all the time because I would just keep a whole wad of ones, because, you know, like there was a time when every corner you came up, somebody wanted to wash your window for $1. I said, you don't have to wash my window. I just give you $1, you know, and it was automatic. They said, oh, you shouldn't get those people money. You're not just going to go and buy a fifth of liquor with it. I said, well, you know, if I was living on the street in that condition, I might go and buy a fifth of liquor myself. You know, just to kill the pain. Just to, you know, I don't know what I might do. So I didn't judge them in that way. And some of them said, well, you know, I read this story, and it actually was true. Because there was a lady who lived across the street from me. And we thought, like, she had inherited, you know, her mother's house, and she couldn't fix it up, and she was a hoarder, and she was a bag woman. And, you know, but you know, when she died, she had over $200,000 in her mattress, you know, because she was going out begging every day and coming in. And so they say, well, some of these people, they got money. This is just a scam that they have. You know, but everything we do for ourselves. So when I give that dollar in my own good heart, then that's a merit that inures back to me. You know, now, that's a way to think about things. And it's a way for one to not become crusty and hardened. I mean, a dollar won't break you. No. It's a practice of letting go. It could be a practice of giving to whom you think is not worthy of a gift, who doesn't deserve. It's just a practice of loosening. You see, it's things like it's very simple things that we can do. He said, our teacher, our great teacher, is the one who's in front of us railing on us. So consider the one who's yelling at you and who's being offensive as your great teacher. If you're getting angry, if anger is welling up, ha, he showed you something in you. That's a hard practice right there. But now, if we're going to call ourselves practitioners, I don't like the word because, you know, I don't think that, you know, these football players that make millions of dollars, but they don't call themselves football practitioners, you know, because they have to play in the real game. That's where the money is made. So we have to be in the real game, is what I'm saying to you. Yeah. Our coming here should be the least of what we do, not the crown and glory of our week. You know, something like can't wait to fall in that door because I need the sangha. Yeah. But when we fall in that door, we should be bringing something with us. We should be bringing our fullness of capacity. We should be bringing with us the fragrance, the incense of our actions for the week. So I know you didn't, what is that strange song that she was singing? Incense burning. All space is filled with its fragrance. We're not burning any incense. But it's incense in the sense of offering up the sweetness of our words and our actions. Offering it to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in the 10 directions. And if someone didn't even think that there were such maha beings, if just the simple act of doing it causes us to enter into a certain kind of reverence and respect, then it has achieved its purpose. Doesn't even matter whether it's real or not. Because everything, the Buddha said, is mind created. So this whole world, we created that. We created it with our thoughts and our speech and our actions. And if we don't like what we see, no, we have to change it with our thoughts and with our speech and with our actions. And if right now I'm so pissed off, I'm pissed off with the president, the administration, those people that are burning up the planet, destroying the planet, I'm just mad with everybody right now. Then that's all I put out there. And I fan those flames and I fuel the demise of our civilization as we know it. That's how important our every thought is, our every word, our every action. So I ask you, do you consider that? Do you really even believe that? Now, whatever we do here as a sangha, we say we do it as a sangha, but there is really no sangha. It's just a bunch of people together. And we call it sangha, but the action of the sangha is the action of the individuals in the sangha. So what are we doing as a sangha? What are we doing individually? My piece of the puzzle, or my piece of the whole of the sangha. Because that's what I bring through that door. So this practice is very personal in that way. And it's a full-time job. You know, we don't have time to look at what anybody else is doing. We don't have time to be judging anybody else. We can be looking at ourselves, encouraging ourselves that I have the Buddha nature, that I have limitless wisdom, that I have the good heart. And once I line up with that and agree with that, then I start acting out of that. mind is chief mind, made of wheat. Whatever we think and ponder on becomes the inclination of the mind. So whatever the mind thinks about, in other words, it thinks about more. So if I think about compassionate things more, the mind automatically starts, oh, she likes that, and it keeps tripping out more compassionate thoughts. You know how it goes in the other direction. You know, somebody irritated you a little bit, and the more you thought about it, the more irritated you got. You know, it's like when you're on your job at the water fountain, and you go to the water fountain when everybody's gathering, because whoever's not at the water fountain, that's the one that gets talked about. So you make sure you show up at the when they're gathering at the water fountain, so you stay in the loop. Yeah. And you know how something is like said, and you know, just general conversation. But if you watch how a conversation can go, I don't know, like nuns, we're not supposed to like get into entertainment, you know. But I do watch Dharma movies. So one of them was, what's that movie about the husband and wife? He became the president now. When it went off, she was the president. I know y'all watch TV. Yeah, House of Cards. Yeah, yeah. So, but you know, it was amazing to me. I would like, I'd do the binge. You know, because I'm like so busy, I have to pick a couple of days and then watch all 12 episodes, you know, and then get back to work. But in that period of time, you know, that would cover maybe a couple of years in the story, you could see how a little leaven leavens the whole lump. You could see how he started just being a little bit bad, just telling little bitty lies to killing people, you know, and how, you know, one thing set up another, set up the condition for another, set up, and that's why I call them Dharma movies, because if we get confused about how things happen, these movies help to show us in quick time, you know. We don't have to experience it for ourselves, you know, and then you could just see how that one little thing tipped and how we become habituated and something. Before, you know, like, who is this person? We don't even know how we got that way. But the good thing is, the same way with such a gradual tipping, there's hope for us, because we could like just tip in the other direction, you know, gradually. And that's how we change. We don't even have to tell anybody, hey guys, I got off. You don't even have to tell it. Just get back on the path. That's all. He said, and when we make that determination, you know, when I've not done all that I know to do, it might be enough for somebody else. But I ask myself, what will I render for all of the benefits that I receive? This is a wonderful life for me. I don't have everything that I could want, you know? But I am appreciative of what I have. And so it gives me a certain kind of contentment. And when we get into that place of fewness of wishes, we find out how much of an abundance we really have. And we find means and ways to share effortlessly what we have. But if we think we don't have enough, never have enough, never have enough, a kind of seed of dissatisfaction sets in such a way that even when we live in a good life, we're suffering. Yeah. So that's what I mean. That's what the Buddha means when he says our whole life is fabricated. Our whole life is an illusion. It's a delusion. It's not my delusion about your life. It's your delusion about your life. I'm deluded about my own. But as we do these two things, practicing effacement, you know, he said in sutta number, I think it's 6 or sutta number 8 in the Majjhima Nikaya, he said, You call meditation practice, but I don't call it practice. Now, in another place, another Dharma talk, to those he was speaking to that were present that day, he did call it practice, you know? But in this particular one, I like it because he said, I don't call that practice. He said, I call that a pleasant abiding here and now. He said, but what I call practice is what you do off the pillow. When you're having to face, you know, unpleasant circumstances and unpleasant people, the vicissitudes of life, the insecurities that come, the cravings, the things that we don't like, how do we handle ourselves then? He said, that's where the practice needs to be done. But when the practice is done well, when we sit, we easily drop in. Why? Because we've been tearing down that discriminating mind. The mind says, good, bad, high, low. It's that discriminating mind. There is just whatever's happening. And we don't have to label it high or low, in or out, up or down, good or bad. It is happening due to causes and conditions. So he says to look not at what is happening, but how. So shifting our focus from the what and the who to the how. How is this occurring? How is this showing up in this moment? The cause and condition. He said, after a while, you'll only see causality. You'll only see cause and condition. Then you're not perturbed, not upset when something happens. How could it be otherwise? You know, you're not too happy when something good happens. How could it be otherwise? And we get into a certain ease and a certain balance in life. And people say, what are you doing? You know. And then we start talking about accepting things just as they are. You know, but right now, maybe we talk about it more than we do. But the practice is in the doing. You know, we don't even have to talk about it. Just in the doing of it. So that's the easy way to practice. It's the effortless way, but it's an exciting way because it takes up your whole life. How many feel sometimes like their practice is getting stale? Then you know, like it's not your practice that's getting stale, you're not practicing. That's why it's stale. Because we're wanting to screw this off. Pull something in. By gosh, I've got it. But he said, you got to walk it out. You know, they have this thing, ever since Bruce Lee, I used to love Bruce Lee, and I was a martial artist, and he came up with these, I think he was one of the first ones, where, you know, where they have the electrical stimulation to pump the muscles. And I was like, yeah, that's the lazy man's way to exercise. I want one of those, you know. And then the scientists started saying, well, you know, like you could just think that you're exercising and your body actually responds, you know. And in one sense, that's true. But if you lay in bed for a year and don't get up and walk, just think about walking, your muscles gonna atrophy, okay? And so we have to do. And when we do, we gain confidence in our own ability. And not in the little selfing ability, but in the ability of the Dharma in us to succor, to comfort, to encourage, to illuminate our path. Not us, but the Dharma in us to be a very present help in the time of need. Not us, but the Dhamma in us that sets up right what has fallen over. Not us, but the Dhamma in us. And the mind starts thinking in that way. And self falls apart, just collapses, just disappears. No effort, got to put down self, got to put down self. Can't do it in that way. But when we focus on the virtue of the Dhamma, and we focus on the needs of others and being a very present help in that time of need, then one comes up into the fullness of the measure of the stature of a Buddha. Can somebody tell me what time it is? Oh, all right, great. So I'd like for us to think about, as we go into a meditation, do we need a bathroom break? We do? Okay.